This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest today is Daniel Mark Epstein, poet, biographer, historian. He'll open our program with an opening poem.
The Twins. The secret of twins is that they have no secrets, but a code like the jargon of bees or the rushing of a creek through grasses. So what is known to one is known to the other. Falling into step along the beach or boulevard, surrounded by light or shadowing each other, the twins project a harmony so perfect that, to all of us born lonely, destined to struggle as lovers, parents, brothers, reluctant strangers, they are a mystery and mild reproof. We dress them alike, angry over our strangeness, envying those blessed to be born separate and one. On the green seesaw of their delicate incarnation, the twins balance, a perfect closed parenthesis.
The voice of Daniel Mark Epstein. I'm Grace Cavalieri. He has been honored with many awards, including the Prix de Rome from the American Academy and Institute of Arts and Letters, a Guggenheim. His poetry has appeared in the Atlantic Monthly, the New Yorker, the New Republic, the Paris Review, is widely anthologized, and he is known as one of the best biographers in America, essayists, translators, but today he is a poet, and this is where I knew him first, and this is what we want to focus on best. Daniel, you've been called the master of the lyric form. What does that mean when you hear that? What do you think lyric form is?
Well, I think it's the kind of it's the most intense form of poetry, and it's the kind of poetry that takes most advantage of the music of the language. So it's those things.
How do you get there?
Well, I think you have to have a basic love of words, just the sound of words, and maybe a bit of musical ability as well. I played the guitar when I was a kid, and I loved to sing and play the guitar.
But it's meter and rhyme. Also, you do use the formal measures.
Well, I learned to do that first. I learned the formal measures. I learned how to write sonnets and iambic pentameter and write quatrains. And when I was a young man, I wrote a lot of ballads. But whatever kind of verse you're writing, even if it's free verse, it has to have the rhythm of the emotion in it. Otherwise, to me, it's really not poetry.
And that all shows up in your work, I think. And also the dramatic narrative is something that crops up when they talk about your name. And as with Frost, who would combine dramatic form with Shakespearean sonnet, what do you say is dramatic narrative?
Well, I think that my own abilities as a lyric poet very quickly merged with my desire to tell stories. I think that one thing that runs through all of my work after the first poems is this desire to tell stories. That's part of what made me a biographer and a verse dramatist too. I love stories.
But you're our poet today, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and I've known your work for 25 years, and so don't stop now.
Well, do you think it's changed any?
That is a good, very good question. You're going to turn the tables on me. I do see a change since No Vacancies in Hell.
Well, I would think so. That was about 30 years ago.
That was 30 years ago.
If there wasn't some change, I would think that I hadn't been doing my job.
However,
as a poet,
I would recognize you in a closed room. I would recognize you without your name on the book. So the voice has not changed. I think some of your devices have become more sophisticated. But let's hear another poem.
Well, I'm happy to hear that. I want to write a poem too.
But right now I'm reading.
This is a poem, really, which is about the writing of poetry, disguised as a poem about a bird, the bobolink.
Mm.
You rise from dry meadow grass with a laborious flutter, more wing action than the shortness of your flight would seem to call for. And so it seems obvious, flying for you is a steep effort. Nature exacts, though not without amends, bobolink, reed bird. The wiry tones of your song set forth a waltz in clear whistles at first, so well sustained. But then you break down the bars, stampede your notes into a reckless song fantasia piped at lightning speed no one can follow. Not the barn swallow, who soars with such grace, not the bird watcher stalking the field, not blind Tom with all his skill at sound catching, his passion for filling darkness with music. Rice bird, reed bird, bobolink, your song is the strained apology for all of the weak winged, condemned to sing because we cannot fly.
The voice of Daniel Mark Epstein. I'm Grace Cavalieri. The thing I think that works for you so well is that your poetry can be achieved on the literal level. I mean, if someone wants to read about a bobolink, let them. I mean, it's a beautiful poem. And then there are the veils that you can peel off. And I think that's typical of some of your poetry, not all of your poetry, that you start with a metaphor. And that's a good example. Also, the fact that it is from your new book, The Traveler's Calendar. Do you like this book?
Oh, I do. I do. When people ask me what my favorite poem is, I usually say the poem that I wrote most recently. So this, at the moment, is my favorite book. Yes, I like for my poems to work on a number of different levels. One poet, I can't remember his name, said that he used to show his poems first to the greengrocer and make sure that the greengrocer, who really was a person with not a whole lot of education, appreciated the poem just on the literal level. This is a poem that, of course, it's a very careful description of a bird, a bobolink, and that strange shortness of the flight. But actually is a poem about how all of us compensate in life, because most of us don't get exactly what we want. We can't fly, and so we sing.
That's
the way it is with poets. They sing because they can't fly.
The Traveler's Calendar has been applauded by Lewis Simpson, said it carries forward the tradition of writing in meter and rhyme and transcends all fashions in verse. So you're not trendy.
I like to hear that.
Yeah. And he calls it poetry of the highest order. Ed Hirsch says Daniel Mark Epstein is writing at the height of his powers, and his seventh collection of poems is his best yet. That's great. The Traveler's Calendar is a book of night thoughts of the poet in the middle of his life, peering backward and musing forward, marveling at the mysteries, dramatizing other lives, other histories, and daydreaming about his own crafting, his song with a gift and a passion, as he puts it, for filling darkness with music. That's beautiful praise from Edward Hirsch.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be praised by, or to have
the
nice things
best.
Said about you by poets that you really admire.
But you've been kind of put off by some critics at some point. However, I've actually never come across anything that was untoward at all. But of course, the author will find in the margin of some magazine something that he doesn't like. However, let's move on to another.
I think I've been pretty fortunate with the critics. Generally, people don't bother to write about poetry unless they like it.
Oh, that's a good point. I was reviewing a book and somebody said, if you don't put something bad in it, Grace, it's not a good review. And I said, how about being on the side of the creator? And I only review the things I like anyway. Let's go to another poem.
All right. Here's another poem that really is it's a thinly disguised poem about the writing of poetry. Here I imagine the night thoughts of a lion tamer. The poem is called The Lion Tamer at 2 a.m., and we can imagine the lion tamer after a long day in the ring. The crowd is always on the lion's side, against the man with the whip. They wish the spangled girl would slip from her spotlight on the trapeze and fall like a meteor on the ringmaster. The inner eye turns glory to disaster. Hard to survive this art, harder to please. Always the danger, there is not danger enough to kill, the spice the crowd prefers to love. But do not call that preference cruelty, which is just human nature. Great success leads all too soon to failure, as men make nature bow unnaturally. While I put old lions through their paces, fathers get bored, the children become restless, hoping against hope I will be mauled, for they have paid to see the risk and want blood. The art, they applaud, sidesteps violence, and this is why they go home from the circus sad. How can I make a show with 10 tame lions? I'll need 5 rude savages to save the act.
I have to then comment on what Charles Tomlinson wrote, where he uses this poem. He said, Epstein, like the protagonist of his poem, The Lion Tamer at 2 a.m., is a performer who knows the danger of performance. Rhyme and half-rhyme, stanza forms an enchantment. They celebrate and make articulate the intricacy that the poems contain. So he saw it as a high-wire act, a high-wire balancing act. I saw it as the danger of putting yourself on the page.
Well, it's all of those things, and then there's always the future, the difficulty of the next poem, and a kind of wildness that one has to preserve as your technique evolves and you become more sophisticated. You mustn't ever, as a poet, you mustn't lose that that sense of the savagery, really, of human emotions. That perhaps that's too strong a word.
No, that's a good word.
You have to stay close to the bone.
That's good, because Richard Wilbur speaks of you that way, about your openness of poetry. And I think that he and Donald Hall, too, have commented on what I see as the passion that keeps you going. We love the structure. You know, we love the containment and the elegance of the restraint. But you have to have that old heart in the middle of it, don't you?
That's right.
Beating
That's
away.
Right. You always have to go back to the source of things and not be too caught up in surfaces.
Yeah, that's the humanities in this book, The Traveler's Calendar, and that's Overlook Press. And it's his newest book. And of all of his books, the other titles are No Vacancies in Hell, The Follies, Young Man's Gold, The Book of Fortune, Spirits, and The Boy in the Well. Those are just the poetry books. And we will get to the other ones. And let's hear another poem. Tell us the book it's coming from.
This is from a book that was published several years ago called The Boy in the Well. And it's a poem about my father, The Inheritance. The night his heart stopped, and my father drove the Cadillac haywire into a shadow. Nobody knew where he'd been. A heap of money lay strewn across the front seat as if death had thrown it back in his face. In the ignition dangled his cryptic keys. My job, to find the locks for those keys and what they guarded. A puzzle my father left scattered in his wake for me to face. I had to open the doors under his shadow, though one might easily open upon my death, a scene of vengeance, or a vault full of money. All we ever argued about was money, his love of it, my disdain. Now the keys to his kingdom fell to me, as if death had longed to cast me in a role my father created, while he watched from a shadow, as I fumbled at entrances he refused to face at the end. Weary, confused, he would not face any problem he could not kill with money, adoring women, the law's relentless shadow that trailed him, rattling chains and prison keys, his failing heart, his curious son. My father knew he was dying and tried to buy off death with coin of the wrong realm. When death laughed and threw the cash back in his face, it must have been that moment my stunned father saw the border of the dominion of money and love beyond. Too late to explain the keys to me as I cried angrily after his shadow, too late for me to hear him once his shadow faded into that crowd in the halls of death. Without a word of advice, I got these keys to a dangerous treasure. I see his lonely face smiling upon my grief that all the money I find won't buy a farewell for my father. Father, open the door behind the shadow money cast between us, and then death. Face me, bless the bearer of these keys.
That's Daniel Mark Epstein. We're at the Library of Congress, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. That is one of your most beloved poems.
Well, it certainly has gotten quite a response. I think it's one of those poems that it's essential in terms of my telling my own story, because of course my father's essence, I think, is really captured in that poem, and my relationship with him. He and I had very different values. We loved each other very much, but you really feel those differences shortly after the death of a parent.
But the love comes through.
But the love comes
through.
Salvages
the poem, really. I mean, it's not a bitter poem. It's a love-hate poem, a bittersweet. It is a beautiful piece of writing. Was that hard-earned?
Well, a lot of people don't realize, unless I tell them, that it's a sestina. The sestina is a very, very complex form of poetry that was it was done first by I believe Provençal poets in the late Renaissance. Anyway, it's a rather difficult form, but the poem naturally formed itself that way.
Tell them the formula. Six.
Well, it's maybe you can do this because you're a teacher.
We'll Grace, just say that it has six lines, and that certain words have to be repeated at different ends, line ends. But the thing about this poem is that it is seamless. The way I value form is if I don't know its form. And I'm so glad you reminded me of that, because there is no way that you can see that we shoved a word in there to make it fit.
Well, thank you. It just naturally wrote itself that way, and it's the only sestina I've ever written.
And I think it does take an end stanza of two or three lines.
Three lines, which also include the six N words that are used all through the poem.
No easy thing. So how did you do that? Did you write it in free verse first and then form it, or did it come and flow?
It came, honestly, this poem actually came out that way. And what hardly anybody believes is that usually when you're writing a sestina, once you've figured out what those six N words are going to be, then the trick is to remember the order, the proper order that those words are supposed to appear in. And I actually wrote the poem without a crib sheet, and later went back. And I guess I had internalized, from so many years of reading sestinas, I must have internalized the form so that it just worked for me. So,
you know, like
I
Yeats,
got lucky.
Like Yeats, I'm in touch with spiritualists. And I do believe your father, that was the gift your father gave you.
Well,
he just channeled that right through. He said, I'm going to give him something he really likes, poetry. Forget the cash.
That's wonderful.
That's good. Let's hear another poem.
All right. This is I'm also, one of the things, of course, that moves me as a poet is beauty. And this is a poem about a beautiful woman who was late. Lateness. Because the past cannot bear to part with her, the present suffers. So we wait. In a lobby under the eyes of chandeliers, in train stations, on a street corner, and at midnight in the graveyard with a spirit who waited in this world and waits in the next, for her October hair and bright May skin have taken since the beginning of earthly time and will take forever. Time goes with her wherever she stops. The moments turn and spin. Little minutes are doves eating out of her hand, but when the hours call, she does not answer. Because her worth is beyond question or value, kings have died for her and worlds collided, skies caved in and hills leapt in the blue. Her touch can melt the ice caps, make buttercups flash in the desert and wild daisies. Poets have climbed to heaven singing her praises. It isn't for spite she keeps you waiting there at the small end of night's telescope. No, it's not to belittle you with your bruised corsage and trail of crushed cigarettes left behind, your shadow of beard, the useless theater tickets. You are probably the farthest thing from her mind. Maybe a street singer took her by surprise, or the pattern of a scarf, scarlet and pearl gray, made her pause and muse in the window. Then the moon would not let her go until it passed. Maybe later in the street, admiring children circled her on skates and led her away, laughing, into a wide park where it seems her gentle protests failed as she tried on their silver wheels and showed them whirling figures they had seen before only in dreams. Because of this, and the endless flattery of twilight, the gay breeze beneath the sad story of each star, she must honor the times that make her beautiful. And the wonder is not that she is late tonight, but that anyone has ever seen her at all.
Dan Mark Epstein, we are going to continue with your poetry throughout the hour. What book is that from?
This is from a book from 1995 called The Boy in the Well and Other Poems.
I have to just take a short shift, though, because there are so many things about you and so many things I've watched over the years. And one is my interest in your verse plays, because that is a form of dramatic literature that is not for the faint of heart. And I just wanted to have your take on that, because I remember the first one that was off Broadway could have been 1980, maybe?
There was one in 1981 called The Midnight Visitor.
That was a verse play.
That was a verse play, and I think it was the first verse play that was done off-Broadway since Hogan's Goat.
That's the one.
It had been about 10 years.
Yes, and why is it that these plays do not have a greater life? I mean, you go to all the cliches about how people do not read poetry and, therefore. But people go to poetry readings, and I wonder why the verse play is not considered more theater, quote, unquote. I mean, T.S. Eliot's does not do well. Endor and Cain, which are Howard Nemroff's such fine works. I can name many poets' plays. What is your feeling? Did you have a good experience?
Well, it was a very exciting experience. All of my theater experiences have been interesting. But I think the problem with verse drama has to do with the audience's insistence on naturalism in the theater. And that's really it's a 20th century development that happened after Ibsen, who ironically also wrote verse plays at the beginning, but eventually turned to prose as his medium. Because the audience, poetry can be written for a single person sitting in a room. Theater, drama has to be written for a whole lot of people sitting together in a theater.
Did you take into
and
account
they just wouldn't
character?
Accept. Oh, of course.
And
of course. The
foreshadowing and
all
dramatic
the,
structure.
Absolutely. My plays are sort of old fashioned, well made plays. And the problem with those plays, I think, was not the characterization or the dramatic development. In a lot of cases, I think the problem was that the language was simply too rich for the audience to take it in.
Yes, on the auditory level, that it's a lot. People aren't used to concentrating. But I'm not here to say that they were not successful, because as verse plays, they had runs with, I think, adulation and approbation. Really, they really had a lot of.
Well,
good,
they were. They
but
were
they
mixed.
Were. The,
there were two. There were two that got a good play. One was,
Jenny and the Phoenix
was the first, and that was done in the late 70s in Baltimore, And it had a long run in Baltimore and wonderful reviews.
Ah.
The Midnight Visitor ran for 6 weeks in New York, despite mixed reviews. I mean, there were critics. I got the worst review I've ever gotten in my life from the New York Times. And they just, you know, they didn't go for it at all. But still, the play had its run. And I think it's important for poets to push the envelope.
I like that.
To try other media. And it was great. I learned a great deal from it.
In your young life, you have done it all. Almost. You've done everything.
Well, I don't know about that, but
I've done everything.
I've certainly written a lot of different kinds of things.
We'll read some more poetry now, and then we'll move on.
All right. This is a poem. It's a poem called The Collection. All of us have been in the position of having to collect something owed us or being collected from. I rode 100 miles in a limousine, gun in my belt to capture what was mine. He knew what was coming, held the door for me, poured the drink, I knocked back spitefully. I told him if he did not pay me what he owed, I would take away his car, his house and furniture, his land, the ring from his finger from his hand. I told him if he did not pay me X amount of cash by Saturday, there would be no Sunday. I would take, one by one, the weeks of his month away, the days of his year, the years of his life. I'd take away his children and his wife, all he ever dreamed or had not dared yet dream, that, too, nothing would be spared. He nodded. When I had gone out the door, leaving it open for the night to enter, I wept, because I didn't know for sure what the man owed me, what I had come for, or how I'd lived without it for so long. My rage was old already, the night was young. Under the cracked laughter of the moon, I ordered my patient driver to move on.
That's a very mysterious ending. However, it strikes me that we never can get what people don't want to give us, can we?
No, we can't. I hope you're not going to ask me what this poem means.
It doesn't matter. It means to me something to me, and that's all that matters. Because you try all you will, but there's just no way. And I can apply that to the writer's life if I want.
I suppose you could interpret it that way. To me, it was about what people owe us, you know, and what we can collect. And
but I like the old rage.
And how the terms change. You can think that somebody owes you something, and then the more the time passes, and the more your life changes, and whatever it was you thought was owed. That's changed, too. You can find yourself in the present feeling like you owe them something and they don't owe you anything.
What is the line? My rage?
My rage was old already. The night was young.
That says everything.
So you've expended your rage after a certain amount of time and in not getting what you thought you were owed.
That is Daniel Mark Epstein. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. One moment we want to just digress and mention that Daniel is the biographer of, well, Edna St. Vincent Millay, Amy Semple McPherson, Nat King Cole, quite a range, I might say. But just out is Lincoln and Whitman. Subtitle is Parallel Lives in Civil War Washington. And this is a great year to come out because we have coming up, 150th year of Leaves of Grass, Whitman's anniversary.
That's right.
And let's just take this book for a minute. This is out by what publisher?
It's been published in hardcover by Ballantine Books, and it's going to be published by Random House in paperback in February.
Oh, that's nice.
This February. I'm very excited about that.
That is pretty good, yeah, because it should be in the classrooms. And I want to just take your process as crisply as we can for a man who probably spent, what, 10 years on it?
No, I think I spent my whole life on it.
Oh, your whole life? Well, give or take a few.
I started reading Whitman when I was a kid, and of course, I've always had a fascination with Lincoln. Lincoln appears in several of my poems. So in a way, I feel like I've been working on it my whole life. Actually, the research for this particular book took about 2 years, and the writing of it took maybe a year and a half or 2 years.
Well, that answers my first question. But at what moment in all of the general feelings of devotion you had to these two figures, did you say, I need to set the record straight and do it my way? What triggered that?
Oh, I think it really, there was a historical problem. Henry Rankin, the man who said that he heard Lincoln reading aloud from Whitman, there was no corroboration for this evidence. That was the main evidence that Lincoln was influenced by Whitman. And I felt that I needed to go to bat for Walt Whitman and have a look at all of Lincoln's speeches and Walt Whitman's poems and see if I could find some connection and some influence. And I struck it rich. I just put my finger on a point in Lincoln's development where it's very obvious from three of the speeches that he gave, including the House Divided speech, that he was very much influenced by Leaves of Grass, and I'm able to use the tools of the New Criticism, which is the way I was educated, to look at these texts and prove it. So it's pretty exciting.
For the reader, the excitement is this consummate knowledge you have of each, because the way they crisscross, for instance, just the line I think you say in Whitman about white as Sumner's hands, I mean, talking about the abolitionist, I thought to myself, just embedded in the most subtle lines, Daniel has to really have this under his belt. This is not something you rush to the book. I mean, you had to be so immersed and so completely filled with each text that you, or else you couldn't have proceeded. I mean, this is
not a lot of ground to cover.
Not index card stuff.
No, there was a lot of ground to cover. And, of course, reading the backbone of the book is my familiarity with Lincoln's writings and with Whitman's poetry, but also there's a tremendous amount of secondary literature. There have been more books written about Abraham Lincoln than anybody but Christ. And Whitman, of course, is a huge industry of scholarship that's been written about Whitman. So there really was a lot of ground to cover in order to be able to approach these towering figures. But it was very exciting.
You said there is a book in 1928 that was called Whitman and Lincoln. Is that true?
That's right. That's right.
And
that was one of the books that of course, influenced me. Reverend William Barton in 1928 wrote this book where he basically, he didn't like Whitman very much, and Lincoln was, of course, considered a saint and a martyr, and this particular writer didn't much like the idea that Whitman could have had any influence at all on Lincoln, or that there could have been even any communication at all or knowledge of that Lincoln couldn't possibly have known anything about Whitman.
Oh.
So I thought it was time to look at all that again. Of course, all of us know the enormous influence that Lincoln had on Whitman because of his great poems, O Captain, My Captain, and When Lilacs Last and the Dooryard Bloomed. We know that he admired Lincoln enormously. And then, of course, he gave that great speech towards the end of his life about Lincoln's death.
Yes, we must take a pause and say that was, I think, read or given at the Madison Square Theater.
That's
in
right.
1873.
1887, I believe.
Oh, dear. I'm arguing with a biographer. Shut my mouth. But you are going to have a moment of glory, I understand, at the Library of Congress.
Well, I'm really very, very flattered. They're having a special event at the Library of Congress on April the 14th this coming year. course, to celebrate the sesquicentennial of the publication of Leaves of Grass. They're going to have an event in the Coolidge Auditorium where they recreate the evening of Whitman's giving the Lincoln speech, and they've asked me to give the speech.
Are you going to read it?
I'm going to read it, just as I'm going to try to do it the same way that Whitman did.
Are you going to sit in an armchair on stage?
Well, I haven't figured all those details yet. Of course, when Whitman gave the speech, he was very old. And he'd had two strokes, and he had to be helped on stage. And I'm thank heavens I'm in a little better health than that. But I don't know. I may decide to sit in the armchair and do it just the way that Whitman did. I may even grow a beard.
We'll be there. That is Daniel Mark Epstein, and April is a big month because that is honoring Whitman, his anniversary, and of course the anniversary of Lincoln's death. So I think this book should be on a lot of desks this year. Just came out, Lincoln and Whitman, Parallel Lives in Civil War Washington. And the one thing I take from this book is I saw the phraseology that Daniel Mark Epstein revealed between the House Divided speech of Lincoln and the Leaves of Grass and the line lengths and the phraseology, and it was proof enough to me that I think you accomplished what you wanted to. So let us go on, because the poet will always get lost when prose rears its head for some reason, and we don't want that to happen today.
Well, thank you. I'd like to read a new poem. This has not been published in a book yet, but it was published in the Raritan Review, which is a quarterly. It comes out of Rutgers. It's called Vision at Dawn. I was wide awake before the wind, bands of coral clouds upon the azure horizon, bright above the lagging sun, closed like a louvered blind, before I found words for the color. Was there no painter at the easel? Was I the only one at his window, on a sleepy street or field of frost, who glimpsed the passing miracle? A lonely thought, chilling as a ghost. I bundled a blanket over my shoulders. Maybe one of my children or neighbors would telephone to tell me they had seen what I remember now uncertainly. The sky was layered gold, then it was gray, or sliced with coral red incarnadine, before the sun came crashing into day to waken the world to its common vision. What death reveals to you, he keeps from me. This is not cruelty, but natural law. The thought that no one else saw what I saw is brother to the darker notion that what everyone sees, I could not see. And this is a heartache as one grows old. There is the wide sky, the hill, the ocean, the maple tree, once draped in shingled gold, that now bears its skeleton to host the crow when the songbird is gone.
Vision at dawn. A little bit of your nighttime mind, which we don't always get. And let's move on to another.
Night thoughts. Here's a joyful poem. And this poem has an interesting story to it. It was lost for 18 years. I wrote the poem about my son, my newborn son. And somehow or another, you know, things are very busy when you have a new child in the house. And this poem got lost. It ended up under a filing cabinet. And when I was moving 18 years later from one studio to another, I found the poem. It's called The Code. I took my son from his weary mother. I gathered him up and paced the living room in a gray sunrise crossed by early lightning. After a little while, he stopped his crying, lifting his head from my shoulder to look around, widening and narrowing his eyes as if the world were stranger than it is to us who have puzzled over all its strangenesses. My face to him is a luminous mystery. He's not old enough to know just what he's seeing. I wonder if anyone ever is. But already he seems to know the code of sound and rhyme. I heard the faraway murmur of spring thunder, and my son smiled at me for the first time.
Theodore?
That's Benjamin.
How many children do you have?
I have 4 children.
What are their names?
Well, their names, you really put me on the spot, Grace.
You can remember their names. I know you can remember their names.
My daughter, whose birthday is today, she's in Paris. She's 28, Johanna Ruth Epstein. And then Benjamin is the second. And then Theodore John, who's 9. And then Nathaniel, who's 4.
Do you know I knew you when you were 25 years of age?
No.
I just want you to know that.
You couldn't be old enough to know me.
Well, I was just a little older. I just had a head start. So that's why it's quite miraculous to see all of these children who were the age I knew you when you first your first book was published. You were a young Turk in Baltimore, the toast of the town. I was teaching in Baltimore, and you came to my class. And that's all I'm going to say about it, because you don't remember it.
I remember the room very well. Your students were very well behaved.
For hippies.
And they were very bright.
Yes, they were geniuses.
I learned a great deal from them.
Either geniuses or burnouts. That's all we dealt with at Antioch. We're dealing with Daniel Mark Epstein, another poem.
What about this little poem? We're getting close to that time. It's called Epiphany. Out in the cold, the contents of a house. Carpets, lamps, and bedsteads, kitchen range, holiday litter, bells and tinsel. Strange, as if a huge hand lifting the residence shook it above the street, while fingers probed corners and closets looking for evidence, clues among new clothes, toys, books unread, and games the children scarcely learned to play. Who lived here last year? Only yesterday. Cardboard Santa and the 3 wise men pause over the lintel to watch a star wink through a flawed cloud. Lost again. Somewhere tonight, a child is being told there will be a better home for him in the new year, a warm bed and fresh linen, constant love and new toys for the old.
How do your children regard you as an author?
Well, the poem that I just read actually was written after I went on a walk with my little boy, Benjamin, and he and I saw this eviction. And the two of us looked at that, and we talked about what that meant, what that might have meant for the family. The poor family that was evicted, and we wondered, you know, if maybe the marriage had broken up and all of those things. I think that all of my children appreciate the fact that I love to write poetry so much and that I love language so much. And they like stories. All children like stories. And I think it's probably the storytelling dimension of the poetry that they respond to first and foremost. Because I've told stories to my children before they ever knew my poetry, they know of me as a storyteller.
Do all the teachers want to drag you into class?
I had to declare a moratorium on that a few years ago because I did do a great deal of I did a lot of work in the Artists in the Schools program. I enjoyed it a great deal,
of course.
But it's really it takes a tremendous amount of energy away from one's work. And as I got older, I just couldn't do it as much. So.
Mm-hmm.
I don't go into the classroom much anymore.
But what do you do, which is ancillary to the book itself? Broadcasts, lectures?
I do a lot of lecturing. I probably do, well, this it goes up and down, but now I'm probably doing 20 lectures a year.
And more than one a month.
More than one a month, and a lot of them some of them are poetry readings. Many of them have to do with the biographies that I've written. I'll be asked to speak on Edna St. Vincent Millay or Walt Whitman or Abraham Lincoln, and I enjoy that.
Edna St. Vincent Millay, much underserved. As we know, she was the talk of the town until the 50s, and then she hit a big crash, and my professors thought, they did nothing but demean her. But we, all most women poets I know, loved her first, loved her best, memorized her as teenagers. I have her first 5 books, first editions, in my safety deposit box. And the first review Mark Van Doren ever wrote in the Boston Globe, which my twins ate and I had to retrieve, and it's not in good shape when they were 18 months old. But I am so connected to her. And when I read your book, What Lips These Lips Have Touched, and that is who published by whom?
By Henry Holt. What Lips These Lips Have Kissed.
What Lips These Lips Have
Kissed.
What a
kissed. Title.
And there's more behind that, too. That's not the end of the title. It might be one of the longest titles in history for a biographer. Let me see if I can find it exactly. The Love and Love Poems of Edna St. Vincent Millay.
That was not my title, but it was forced on me.
After the colon. That's okay.
But I enjoyed writing the book, and I love her poetry, and how smart of you to have saved all of those first editions.
Oh.
I had to go around trying to find them when I was writing the book.
They're at BB&T. In my drawer, and I had them, of course, as a teenager. I found them. They're beautiful. They're in perfect shape, and they gave me my permission to love poetry very, very much.
She's a great writer, and I've heard many poets. Lucille Clifton, who we both admire, has written about Edna St. Vincent Millay and Millay's influence on her. And I've always loved Millay. One of the first long poems I ever memorized was Renaissance.
Right. And you memorized that?
I did.
You know, for a male biographer, I thank you, because mostly only the women's studies have been giving any attention to Edna St. Vincent Millay. I think she's having a renaissance of her
That's
own
changing.
Right now.
Oh, yeah.
It is. I have to tell you about Amy Semple McPherson. Did you know that Kathy Lee Gifford is writing a musical about her?
You know, I heard that somewhere. Oh, you know what? She called me up. Kathy Lee Gifford called me up because we have the same name. Her original name is Epstein. And anyway, she called me to tell me how much she enjoyed my book and wanted to tell me that she was writing this musical based on the life of Sister Amy, and would I like to help? And
was she nice?
A long time. She was very nice.
I think it's
very,
called
very nice.
Hurricane Amy.
Yes.
That's what she's naming it.
Yeah. And is this really going to happen? I mean, have
it's
you heard more
in,
about it?
No, it's still
in
the works.
In development.
But I think she can make it happen, yeah. I think it's actually, she wrote the lyrics, and I believe they're the Kathy Lee Gifford lyrics. They're very popular culture, but it could be interesting.
Well, I wish her luck.
Oh, I know you do. And Nat King Cole, are you a great fan?
Of course. I wrote the biography of Nat King Cole, and a lot of people don't realize that he was one of the 5 greatest piano players, jazz pianists that this country has ever produced. And it really was Nat King Cole, the jazz singer, and of course the creator of the jazz trio, who intrigued me the most, rather than the pop singer who we all loved in the 50s and 60s. Although I like those records too, but he's a fascinating figure. Also a great groundbreaker in terms of civil rights.
And the thing about your biography of each of these individuals is that you always produce unknown material, such as you've just mentioned. And this is what I think is the contribution. For instance, there was much not known about Edna St. Vincent Millay. I mean, you were the first to publish or make public her relationship with George Dylan. And those love letters were not evident before, were they? You were the first.
Well, Nancy Milford and I published biographies in the same week. We had access to a lot of the same material. Now, there are many things in my book that are not in Ms. Milford's book, and there are many things in Ms. Milford's book which are not in my book, because we did have the amount of archival material, which is now at the Library of Congress, by the way, was enormous, just 22,000 items, something like that.
But
so
we read this
quite differently.
Vincent's passion for horse racing and her raising thoroughbreds and spending all of her loot on that because she made a lot of money as a writer.
That was my discovery, actually. I was surprised that the other biographer didn't pick up on that.
I found that to be very interesting. You got a coup on that, because everyone wondered where she made a vast amount of money writing.
And everybody wondered, where did all the money go to?
How much?
It went into the horse racing business.
Did you say it would be equal to like $350,000 a year.
Something like that.
Today, yeah.
It's hard to measure.
Daniel Mark Epstein, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and we could probably do a marathon on your work, but let's hear another poem.
All right. This poem is about language. It's about the word cataract, which means, of course, the terrible thing that happens to our eyesight when we get older, but it also means waterfall. It comes from a Latin word. The cataract. Lately the world seems darker, especially in the evenings, and I light more lamps to see no better than ever familiar faces and things, wayworn works of art, books known almost by heart. Is this the cataract, what the Romans used to call a portcullis, or a waterfall, descending to subtract from the sum of my seeing? A fine word for a hateful thing, though now the doctors say they can lift the veil in a day. Who takes joy in the word for a blur that steals his light? The power is its own reward and a gift of second sight, this joy to build a tower without fear or self-pity, of words for the horror that attends the end of light, a castle to stand bright in the ruins of a city.
You are a translator of Latin and Greek, too.
Yes, I've found that I've learned a great deal from learning the ancient languages.
You didn't just translate from the flat English?
No. My Greek translation is from Greek because I studied Greek and my Latin translation. I know a lot of people now are calling work translation that really is translation from a literal translation into English first. But no, I go back to the original languages. And, of course, I've always loved Euripides, the Bacchae.
And you translated that.
Yeah, got the opportunity to translate that. I'm hoping it'll get performed more. It's had one performance in a college in the Midwest, and I'm hoping it'll get performed more.
I'm glad we said that. I didn't know it.
Well, I minored in classics when I was in college. Here's a poem about gifts and a lovely woman who I gave gifts to, the poem will tell the story. Gifts. I gave her a golden locket to shut my portrait in. She filled it with a butterfly wing, the blue of heaven, and wore it until the day she turned to me from the mirror to kiss, and the locket behind her opened and flew away. I gave her an antique ring some lover had lost in pawn. She gazed from the sea to her hand one night. The diamond was gone. I gave her a chain of flowers that die before they are old. She will outstay diamonds and gold. I will give her nothing but flowers.
And another.
This is a poem that I wrote for my wife, Jennifer Bishop.
Is that your wife?
That's my wife.
Well, the book is dedicated to her.
It is.
And she's a photographer then.
She is.
She took your...
A wonderful photographer.
She sure is. I didn't know that your wife was Jennifer Bishop.
Well, she is.
Well, thanks.
Well, I thank her for this poem. Long shadows on the lawn are all that's left of the night. Mars and the moon have gone under cover of dawn light. Jenny, come down to the garden and see what the day has in store. Watch the hollyhocks open, the crows in the sycamore. For life is a morning shadow that shortens and disappears. And the sun is a high-handed fellow, spinning our months into years and days into nights to show this world is his round delay. May love, like the evening shadows, grow till life and light pass away.
Before we finally hear a last poem, I'd like to know what you are intending to do next. Just what could Daniel Mark Epstein be up to next?
Well, the most I can say is that I'm writing another book on Lincoln. When I wrote the Lincoln and Whitman book, I got to the end of it, and I've never had this sensation before, but I felt like I don't want this to be over. I realize that this book is done, but I've enjoyed doing it so much that I don't want to stop. And fortunately, the book has done well enough, both in the bookstores and among the critics, that I've been given a contract to write another book on Lincoln. So I've started on that.
What shape will it take?
Well, it's really too early to. I don't much like to talk about work that's only a few months along in progress. Because I don't know enough about it yet. When I know more about it, then I'll talk to you about it.
You mean you know you want to write a book about Lincoln, and you're going to discover what you want to write as you write it?
That's sort of what I mean. But actually, I'd have to know a lot more about it before I would talk to you. I mean, I wouldn't tell you everything I knew.
Yeah. But
otherwise,
so
you'd
many
know
people,
as much as I do.
So many people have written about Lincoln. What must there be left? We'll
find
out.
Lots.
We will find out.
There's lots, believe me.
Oh, this is good. When should it come out?
Well, if all goes well and I keep my health, 2 years. Maybe
that's
2 years.
About the run?
2 or 3 years.
And how do you just do a couple of hours a day?
Well, when I'm working on prose, I usually work more than that. I'll work for maybe 3 or 4 hours on the actual writing. And when I'm doing research, I'll research all day long.
And do you think about it night and day?
No. I try to stop at a certain point in the day and think about other things.
Well, we have other programs to do with you, I can just tell. It is Daniel Mark Epstein, and I'm Grace Cavalieri, and here is a final poem.
The poem is called Helen. Tell us a love story, pleaded the class in chorus. Our lessons are all done. Now don't lecture or bore us, they prattled, except for one, Helen, whose gaze looked lost in the maze of willow branches, the girl the boys liked most for the faraway blue of her eyes and brown hair straight as rain. Tell us a love story, please, they begged the teacher again. He frowned and longed for the bell, saying, all the love stories I know end in heartache or death. Then Helen, from the back row, called at last from her daydream in the voice of an innocent lover, tell us a love story anyway, and stop before it is over.
The voice of Daniel Mark Epstein. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media. Post-production is by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. The series is brought to you by the Humanities Council of Washington, D.C. and the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry. Additional funding was provided by the National Endowment for the Arts because a great nation deserves great art. We wish to thank the Motion Picture Broadcasting and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. Our engineer is Bill Haley. I'm Grace Cavalieri.